Over the last 3 years, no issue on the expansive U.S.-China agenda has been more dominant or contentious than that of trade. Since the spring of 2018, the United States and China have been embroiled in a protracted trade war that has damaged both economies to varying degrees and raised serious questions about the future of global trade and the very concept of globalization. COVID-19 has only amplified these questions. Now the United States is in the midst of a presidential transition. Where does the U.S.-China trade relationship stand today? And where is it going under the incoming Biden administration? More broadly, what do the next few years hold for global trade? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to explore these questions is Ambassador Carla Hills, the former United States Trade Representative under President George H.W. Bush. Ambassador Hills, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Ambassador Hills served as the United States Trade Representative from 1989 to 1993. As a member of President George H.W. Bush's cabinet, she was the president's principal advisor on international trade policy, as well as the nation's chief trade negotiator. Over the course of her career, she also served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and as an Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Among many other affiliations, Ambassador Hills is currently Chairman and CEO of Hills & Company International Consultants, which advises companies on global trade and investment issues. Ambassador Hills, let's start by taking stock of the outgoing Trump administration's approach to trade with China. What do you think the administration got right, and what do you think it got wrong? And overall, do you think the United States is in a better place in its trade relationship with China today than it was 4 years ago?
Very good questions. I would say that what President Trump got correct in dealing with China was to call out its transgressions. When China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, it agreed to give its trading partners national treatment and non-discrimination. And it had engaged in activities that were to steal intellectual property, to put percentage caps on inward investment, and provide subsidies to companies that were competing globally, and a host of other things that violated the precepts of the World Trade Organization. It was right to call them out on that. What was wrong was there didn't appear to be a strategy nor a plan for how to deal with China. In my own view, had we joined hands with our allies, Europe, Canada, Australia, Japan, North Korea, and confronted China, saying these things violated the club that you joined, and unless you give us a blueprint and timing as to how you're going to abide by the rules that you agreed to, you're going to be ousted from the WTO. And that would have meant that they would not have enjoyed the WTO rules or lower tariffs. And since China is a trading nation, indeed an exporting nation, it needed those sorts of advantages. So I think that our strategy was wrong. It wasn't that we didn't see the sins that had been committed and are, to some extent, still being committed. And, of course, the trade differences have grown into other areas that deal with geopolitics, human rights, technology, and a host of other things that have created animosity.
President Trump made it very clear that his top specific policy goals with respect to the U.S.-China trade relationship was to level out the U.S. trade deficit with China and to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. All the empirical data, however, indicate that over the last 4 years, precisely the opposite has occurred. The average annual U.S. merchandise deficit with China has gone up. Our merchandise deficit with the world has also gone up. We've transformed a historical agricultural trade surplus into a deficit, and manufacturing jobs have been lost, not gained. Is it fair to say, Ambassador Hills, at this point, that based on all the available data, tariffs were simply the wrong tool for this administration to use to achieve its own stated policy objectives?
Absolutely. The whole approach of the Trump administration was managed trade, not free and open trade. And the tariffs that were imposed have badly hurt segments of our economy and along with hurting China and have not accomplished the goals set out.
Though the trend lines in terms of what the data showed were problematic even before COVID-19 emerged, there's no question that COVID-19 has hit economies all across the world very hard and exacerbated the already existing challenges to global trade. In your view, will the impact of COVID-19 on global trade, and in particular on the idea of managing the risk associated with global supply chains, remain with us even after COVID-19 is brought under control?
Well, the question that I would put to your question is, when do we get COVID-19 under control? But it clearly upset global economies. And in the United States, our economy has plummeted. That has occurred around the world. And when COVID-19 is conquered, I think it's going to take time to build back. It won't come back overnight. And so it's going to take some time to rebuild our economies. It's really been a traumatic event that rivals the 1918 pandemic that killed so many people.
Ambassador Hills, let me ask you this follow-up question with respect to COVID-19. All the projections out now suggest that China will be the only major economy that actually ends up posting positive growth in the year 2020. And the estimates are that China will grow this year by the end of the year at what will have been about a 2% rate of GDP growth, whereas the United States, Germany, and all the rest of Europe and all the other major economies will have shrunk to one degree or another, in the case of the United States, by perhaps just over 4%. Do you have a sense for what accounts for this disparity between China on the one hand and all of the other major economies in terms of being able to bounce back rather quickly from the major hit that COVID-19 placed on the global economy?
COVID-19 hit China first, so you would expect it to recover first. But you're right that their 2% growth, United States 4.3% decline in 2020, as the projection of the IMF, is probably is evidence of their speed and very firm grip on causing people to isolate and to wear masks and to take the precautions that were recommended. COVID-19 was a international health crisis in January of 2020. And our leadership kept saying, oh, no, it'll go away. It's just a hoax. We don't have to button down. And so we really didn't take actions for 60 days. And that slowed up and permitted COVID-19 to spread. Again, I tend to think that governments lead by example, and what the Chinese have demonstrated and have talked about in China is that by having central control, the people are safer. And that's not something that we wanted to encourage.
Ambassador Hills, let me ask you a few other quick questions about the U.S.-China trade relationship before touching on topics relating to regional and global trade more broadly. First, what is the status at this time of the U.S.-China Phase 1 trade agreement that was signed nearly a year ago? Is that still a meaningful or relevant framework as we move into the Biden administration, or has it at this point been overtaken by events?
It's not met its expectations that were given to us by those that negotiated the deal. It is a form of managed trade, and it's just a purchase agreement. It's not a trade agreement. What the Chinese have achieved to date is about 39% of its commitment for 2020. We'll have to hope that the incoming administration is able to deal with the problems that truly exist. I do believe that the tone of government will be quite different, and that will make a huge difference as we move forward.
One of the specific issues, Ambassador Hills, that you noted earlier is the issue of intellectual property rights. Many perceive that intellectual property rights, or IPR, issues remain a serious and largely unresolved set of issues in the U.S.-China trade relationship, even after 4 years of Trump administration policies. Where are the United States and China on intellectual property rights protection at this point? And going forward, what is the best way for the two countries to get to a better place on this longstanding issue?
Well, it isn't totally resolved. China has moved forward, according to the U.S.-China Business Council, which does surveys, and has made courts address intellectual property, but there's still huge, huge problems there. I am hopeful that that will be on the list of the incoming administration, and President-elect Biden has stated that he will work with our allies to insist that China do what it said it was going to do in 2001, and that is protect intellectual property. And, you know, diplomacy would indicate that this is in China's interest, because China is in the high-tech area. Well, you're not going to get a lot of innovation, a lot of effort and time given to trying to figure out new ideas if you don't get the rewards for doing so. That's something that China should want to do in its own best interest. And I think that President-elect Biden will try to find areas of agreement with China. And he's already talked about wanting to cooperate in the areas where he can. And there'll be competition in other areas and perhaps confrontation in the non-trade areas that have blossomed in recent years.
In the domain of technology, where U.S.-China competition is arguably most intense, do you see an inherent incompatibility between China's declared aspirations and intentions on the one hand and U.S. interests on the other? And what is your assessment of the U.S. legislative and policy approach over the last 4 years to the technological challenge that China is seen as representing to the United States?
I think that with a better plan, you could work with China. As I mentioned, China wants to be a central power. It wants to be in the global institutions. And if we work with it and have punishments when they don't do what they say they're going to do, I think we would have a better outcome. But we have far more force when we gather hands with our various allies representing 60% of global GDP and say, look, you have to have good intellectual property protection. If there is any theft of intellectual property, there will be penalties that are enormous. And I think that we could have made a difference and still have a chance to make a difference if we find areas where we can work with our allies to confront China where they are engaging in improper behavior.
Let me ask you kind of a follow-up question, Ambassador Hills, on this topic. two of the major laws that were passed over the last several years bear on this issue pretty directly. One is the Foreign Investment Risk Review Modernization Act, or FIRMA, and the other is the Export Control Reform Act, or ECRA. And I just wanted to ask if you think these pieces of legislation actually help the United States around this cluster of issues related to technology, or if, on the contrary, the costs to this legislation actually outweigh the benefits from a U.S. standpoint.
Well, I think the costs are very high. I would have, and export controls have been around, have been used, but they should not be used indiscriminately. And so, yes, I think that you're right, that the two laws probably have cost us more than the gains we hope to get.
There are about 7 weeks left before President Trump's term of office comes to an end. Do you expect that we'll see any further significant administration actions on U.S.-China trade during the remainder of this transitional period?
I have to confess, I hope not. I think that if President Trump wants to take action that make it harder for his successor to work with China, that would be extremely unfortunate. And so I hope that the transition is smooth and that there is more collaboration as there have been in other administrations. You know, every administration that I served, the president worked and his team worked to make the new administration come in and be up to speed, working effectively, and it was quite collegial. But we will see. I have no perfect crystal ball.
Both President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris have spoken publicly about the inefficacy, as they see it and as many others see it, of the Trump administration's approach to U.S.-China trade, noting, for example, the fact that deficits with China have actually gone up, not down, and that Americans, not Chinese, are paying the Trump tariffs. Where do you see the Biden administration going on the issue of trade with China generally?
Well, I think that first and foremost, I believe that the tone with all governments, China, Russia, and our Western allies will change and will be far more diplomatic. And secondly, I think that President-elect Biden will strive to find areas of agreement with China where the two governments can work together, for example, on climate, world health, denuclearization. And you know, when you work across borders with a country, you develop bonds so that it lets you work better in other areas. And thirdly, I think, and I believe he's so stated, that he will work with China on the issues where we and our allies are in agreement, that China's actions in areas that I've already mentioned, intellectual property theft, non-compliance with the rules governing subsidies, percentage caps on inward investment, are unacceptable and must be stopped, or they will pay the price of being excluded from the World Trade Organization. And fourthly, I believe he will try to remove tariffs against our allies that have hit our workers and has simply let China increase its purchases in the sectors that have been hit by tariffs to buy from others. And so your data is absolutely right. The data hurt the United States. But having said all these things, I don't think he'll have a totally free hand. It looks to me that probably the Republicans will continue to control the Senate, and both parties, Democrat and Republican, have taken quite a hard stance, in my view, against China on a range of issues. You know, there are over 360 bills dealing with China that have been introduced in this congressional session. But on the other hand, to be an optimist, President Biden will have had 36 years of experience in the Senate including as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And I think that will help him navigate in today's troubled waters, which in my view are not going to calm down in the short term. It's going to take us a while to dig out of a hole that we find ourselves in today.
To drill down just a bit on the specific issue of U.S. tariffs on incoming Chinese imports, do you think there's any likelihood that President Biden will be able to lift the tariffs relative to Chinese imports as he's publicly pledged he would like to do? And toward that end, does the fact that about three quarters of self-identified Democrats say that they oppose the Trump tariffs make it easier for him politically, perhaps, to get this done on the grounds that getting rid of the tariffs is actually good for America?
I think that people are beginning to recognize that the tariffs cost big time. They cost our companies that are finding themselves less competitive, have fewer exports and fewer sales at home, and they hurt our workers as our companies cannot get the same kind of business. And so, yes, I think that the Congress will try to work with him where the tariffs are demonstrably harmful to our economy.
And noting a theme that you've mentioned, Ambassador Hills, is it a fair expectation to think that the Biden administration will place a greater emphasis on working with our allies and key trading partners, as you've noted, in order to deal with China from a position that's more coordinated and unified, something that we really have not seen under the Trump administration?
Absolutely. I think that President-elect Biden will definitely reach out to our allies and try to work with them. And his tone will be diplomatic. You know, if you read some of the comments that President Trump has used toward our friends, calling them stupid and weak and ineffective, you know, it's very hard to get a group together to work with you if your diplomacy is so lacking.
On the issue of the broader topic of Asia-Pacific trade and global trade, which we'll turn to here in a second, what is your take on the recently signed Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, the largest free trade pact ever signed, involving about 30% of the world's population and 30% of global output? Could the Biden administration get the United States back into play with respect to RCEP, or has that ship already sailed?
What I would like to see him do first is to re-enter the Trans-Pacific Partnership for the reason that it has higher standards and is a more complete agreement. But then he could move to RCEP and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. There you have China as a member, and it would have that positive effect of trying to have a set of rules that at least China again has agreed to. So I believe that both agreements are worth his time and his energy working with his trade representative.
Developments over the last several years have prompted some to wonder whether the World Trade Organization itself has a viable future. As you look at the state of world trade today, do you think the WTO as an organization and as a framework for global trade can survive? And by the way, might the world as a whole actually move toward a more autarkic or less interdependent economic footing, as seems to have been suggested by things that we've seen over the last several years?
I think that it'll take leadership to rebuild and to strengthen the WTO. It has to be modernized. It was created 25 years ago, and we didn't have digital trade and a host of other things that have developed in the past quarter century. But it's to everyone's advantage to have the WTO, but it wouldn't exist if the United States hadn't picked up and led on the effort. and which it has done since the end of World War II with the Bretton Woods agreements that led to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, and then the Uruguay Round, which built on the GATT and created the WTO. But as a free society, we need to have rules governing global trade. And the world is not going to just simply turn inward altogether. We need to have things cross borders if we're going to prosper. So I do hope that we will take a leadership stance and join hands with like-minded nations. Already others are doing that. You know, the Canadian group has a group of 13 that are trying to work on some of the failures of the WTO. A new director general could make a difference. But it's a membership organization, and members have to stand up. They may have to start with a plurilateral agreement, and then others would be drawn in because they would see the advantages. But we can't let the concept of a world trade organization to govern our trade fall into disrepair.
Let me, on a similar note, Ambassador Hills, ask a kind of philosophical question, if you will. And it's regarding the concept of comparative advantage, which I think this administration and many in Congress across the partisan aisle have really kind of waged a war against over the last several years. The idea that the pie gets bigger when countries trade is something that is no longer politically safe to say in this country, seemingly. Do you think a U.S. public consensus can once again be built, both in the nation but specifically in Washington, around the very simple concept of comparative advantage?
I think it can. It's going to take the leadership, and I wouldn't put the leadership basically exclusively on Washington, D.C. I think groups like the Bush China Foundation have a job to educate the public as to why trade matters. Talking to mayors, governors, local groups like the Rotary Clubs, it makes a difference. People have lost faith in trade to some extent, and I think that's the first step in being able to preserve the advantages of comparative advantage. Also, the distribution of the gains. We have to, as I think President-elect Biden has pointed out, deal with some of the shortcomings at home. We have to train our workers to take higher-level jobs. We have a rather long list of social issues and economic issues to deal with. And I think that those two things, educating the public and dealing with the issues at home in terms of distribution of the gains from open trade, have to take place before you're going to get a stand-up and applause from the American public.
Finally, as someone who served in the cabinet of President George H.W. Bush, our foundation's namesake, what is your take on where today's Republican Party is on both China and trade? What are the prospects for the GOP getting back to its more traditional footing on these issues, a footing that would be more recognizable to President George H.W. Bush? And are there any special GHWB-related personal memories that you could share with our audience?
Well, you don't have time to hear all my personal recollections, because I just think that President Bush was an amazing leader. He is persuaded, his background persuades me that those presidents who've had experience make all the difference. And he is a congressman, our ambassador to the UN, head of the CIA, our envoy to China, really knew government, and it showed. He left a wonderful legacy. And he was also a great diplomat. You know, He wrote in his Chinese diaries, I think 2007, one of my dreams for the world is that two powerful giants referencing China and the United States will continue working together in a full partnership and friendship will bring peace and prosperity to people everywhere. And that's what you and I are talking about in our hopeful statements about the future. So I do hope that perhaps our future presidents can take a page from his book and figure out why diplomacy makes such a difference and listen to the experts.
I think that's really well said, Ambassador Hills. And I just want to thank you so much once again for your time and all the insights you've shared with us today. We really appreciate your being with us. Thank you.
Well, it was a great pleasure to join you. I'm honored to do so.
Remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you all so much for listening.